Chapter 4. Ambition and Revanche. The French Republic had been obsessed with the loss of Alsace-Lorraine since 1871. At the National Assembly in Bordeaux in that year, Victor Hugo had trumpeted his undying allegiance to the cause of the lost territories. After him, De Rolde, Barras, and Bourget led the literary chorus of revenge. Noble as the French protest may have been, it didn't take much history into account, particularly that of its own country. France had been quite skillful in the past at annexing the territories of its neighbors. After all, how had Nord, Dunkirk, Lille, Arras, and Douai, all bearing the Germanic eagle on their escutcheons, become united with France? The same went for Roussillon, originally part of Catalonia, as well as Burgundy and Verdun, a German cathedral town until 1552. Toul had only become French in 1648, at the Treaty of Westphalia. Alsace and Lorraine themselves had been acquired in the not-too-distant past. Lorraine had been German for a millennium. Almost 400 years before, Emperor Charles V had dreamed of making it a free and inalienable state, a buffer between France and Germany. The French had had other aspirations, however. In 1633 the French captured Nancy, 133 years later the remainder of Lorraine was seized and annexed. When the Germans retook the province in 1870, it had been French scarcely more than a century. The case was similar with Alsace. In 843 the Treaty of Verdun had made it part of Lotharingia. 27 years later, at the Treaty of Meersen, it had become the territory of Louis the German. From the 12th to the 15th century it had been part of the Duchy of Swabia, and it had enjoyed a flourishing growth. Not until 1679, after French troops led by Marshal Turenne had bested the forces of the German Empire, did the Treaty of Nijmegen acknowledge French sovereignty over Alsace. Strasbourg would remain German until 1681, and the sizable city of Mulhouse did not fall to France until it was seized in 1798. To be sure, the last born, or the last stolen, is often the most beloved. Such was the story with Alsace-Lorraine. And there is no doubt that Alsace-Lorraine would have played a healthier role in European history if it had formed the core of a buffer state between the two rivals, rather than the jousting field of their armies for 1,000 years. Germany under Kaiser Wilhelm II had at length come to realize that the issue of the lost provinces was an impassable barrier to Franco-German reconciliation, and in 1911 Germany had granted autonomy, within the Reich, to Alsace-Lorraine. This despite evidence of growing acceptance of German rule among the population of the provinces, to such an extent that the French historian Renouvin was forced to admit. The citizens of Alsace-Lorraine are aware of the material advantages which accrue to them from the general prosperity of Germany, they no longer accept protest deputies, but send representatives to the Reichstag who take their seats with the German parties, both Catholic and Socialist. La Crise Européenne, page 138. Not only with regard to Alsace-Lorraine, but in colonial matters as well, Germany had sought to appease France, but the French government had remained obdurate. Having conceded France control of Morocco in 1906, Germany received in return a thin strip of unproductive land in equatorial Africa. Moreover, France's new British allies had exerted pressure on Spain to refuse Germany authorization to lay a submarine cable through the Canary Islands to establish telephone communication to the Central African colonies. Undaunted, the German government had offered France close cooperation in 1912, as France's President Poincaré would later admit before the Chamber of Deputies in 1922, it is beyond question that during the entire year of 1912 Germany made sincere efforts to ally herself with us for the common interest of Europe and the maintenance of peace, then adding, but she wasn't ready yet. There, then, was the truth. No matter how eager Germany showed herself to make concessions, as long as Alsace and Lorraine were not under the French tricolor there would be no rapprochement. Had other countries dealt with France in a like manner there would have been no reconciliation with Spain until France had ceded Perpignan back to Catalonia, no reconciliation with Belgium until France had returned the Nord region to its Belgo-Flemish fatherland. For the reconquest of its lost borderlands, however, France looked not for reconciliation but for military strength. The alliance which France concluded with the Russian Empire in 1894 was a strange one. Paris and St. Petersburg were more than 1,000 miles apart, a huge distance in those days before aviation. The French people and the peoples of the Tsarist Empire differed immensely. For the preceding century, the two nations' only meaningful contacts had been as enemies, when Napoleon had led his Grande Armée to Moscow in 1812 and when the French Zouaves had helped British troops occupy the Crimea in 1854. For the moment, however, France and Russia's interests, or at least those of the ruling political elites, coincided. The French Republic needed several million extra soldiers, and Russia had them. Russia needed billions of gold francs to finance its Pan-Slavist and Far Eastern projects, and France was willing to supply them. Neither party was naive about the implications of the deal. The French politicians felt no fondness for the Tsarist autocracy, nor did the Pan-Slav Russian Grand Dukes have any regard for what they called France's mobocracy. Yet the military ties grew increasingly closer, with formal and regular collaboration between the general staffs, joint military reviews, and visits exchanged by the two fleets. The shabby bargain would soon bear fruit. France's drift toward open hostilities with Germany was strengthened by domestic political developments. In 1913, Raymond Poincaré, who had been Minister of Foreign Affairs, was elected President of the French Republic. When Poincaré took over the Élysée Palace from President Félières at the start of that year, Félières is reported to have said, "I'm afraid that war is entering the Élysée behind me." In George Malcolm Thompson's view, it is certain that the Lorrainer Poincaré felt no repugnance for war. There had been opponents of France's Party of Revanche, some of them with great influence. Joseph Calos, a former prime minister and minister of finance, was a powerful politician whom Poincaré feared greatly as a rival. Jean Jaurès, the fiery socialist orator and pacifist, could rouse the masses like no other French politician. With Poincaré firmly in power, however, their voices were powerless to affect the French government's military and diplomatic machinations. Poincaré was not a warm man, neither was he an eloquent or conciliatory one. He was rail-thin, with the eyes of a stuffed owl. I knew him, personally, in my youth. I was astounded, on meeting him, at his shrill voice. He seemed a cold little man, his cheeks puffed out in congenital ill-temper. With whiskers like an iron-gray shaving brush, he seemed a sly fox. He mistrusted other people, and they mistrusted him. A lifelong hairsplitter, he crammed his political and diplomatic activity, his confidences, his parliamentary replies, and his memoirs with so many lies, subterfuges, evasions, and bits of nonsense that the sheer weight of it all was overpowering. He seems to have been honest in his personal financial conduct, a rare virtue among men in politics, finance, and the press, who usually wallow in moral turpitude. Yet his dirty tricks in politics were numberless, and one can only wish he had mulcted a few hundred million francs from the public treasury rather than sent 1.5 million Frenchmen to their deaths in the bloodbath of the First World War. Poincaré could not seek war openly and officially, although secretly he strove for it with all his might. When the war came, he later said, it was a divine surprise. Charles de Gaulle, who, with his hawk's eye, had no equal in looking into the subconscious of his fellow Frenchmen, wrote in La France et son Armée, he did not watch the tragedy approaching without a secret hope. In 1912, however, Poincaré was unwilling to commit himself to the Balkan adventures of the Russian Pan-Slavists. He couldn't mistake Belgrade or Sarajevo for Strasbourg. That suited the Russians, and they went to considerable effort to conceal their intrigues from their French allies. In March 1912, unbeknownst to the French, Russia's ambassador and virtual plenipotentiary in Belgrade, Nicholas de Hartwig, had drafted the secret clauses of the treaty between Serbia and Bulgaria, which stipulated the number of Bulgarian troops that were to be placed at Serbia's disposal in the event of a war with Austria-Hungary. Poincaré was irked by his allies' secretiveness, particularly when his ambassadors could only elicit hypocritical denials from their Russian colleagues. Poincaré for a time remained poorly informed about Russia's Balkan moves, even more so than their mutual German enemy. He was kept in the dark about Russia's provisional redrawing of the borders of its satellite states in the Balkans prefatory to the wars of 1912 and 1913. Despite his caustic objections, when he learned the truth, the president of France had to swallow the Russians' galling explanations as if they were after-dinner mints. In 1913, after finally obtaining the text of a secret treaty between Russia and Bulgaria, he murmured to Sergei Sazonov, the Russian foreign minister, "I call to Monsieur Sazonov's attention that the treaty is a covenant of war not only against Turkey, but also against Austria." Poincaré, Les Balkans en feu, page 113. Sazonov responded in three words, "I must agree," but was no more forthcoming with information about Russia's aims in the Balkans. The new president made every effort not only to prevent Franco-German understanding but also to antagonize Austria-Hungary, which, in his opinion, was too well disposed toward France. For example, Poincaré had personally managed to torpedo a loan applied for on the Bank of France by the Austrians, who had an impeccable financial reputation. The French had previously lent out 45 billion gold francs, one-third of the total to Russia, on most generous terms. Serbia, too, had enjoyed a bit of this French largesse. Regardless of the fact that extending the loan to Austria would have greatly heightened French influence in the great Central European power, Poincaré was determined to give offense to that Teutonic ally of the hated Germans. With the same churlish calculation, Poincaré went out of his way to offend Wilhelm II. In early 1914, after Wilhelm had graciously invited the French minister, Aristide Briand, to a regatta at Kiel, Poincaré forbade Briand to attend, decreeing that an interview of that kind is disturbing and outrageous. Poincaré's diplomats on the spot repeatedly informed Paris of Germany's benevolent intentions toward France. At Berlin, Ambassador Cambon telegraphed Paris a confidence made him by Baron Beyens, the Belgian minister to Germany. "One fact that is absolutely certain is that the German Chancellor wishes to avoid a European conflagration at any cost." The brilliant socialist leader, Marcel Sambat, underlined Wilhelm II's essential caution in his book Fates la Paix ou Fates un Roi: "The German Emperor has braved ridicule and even the reproach of cowardice for 25 years." As Russia continued to step up its intrigues in the Balkans, Paris grew better informed. Serbia was intensifying preparations against Austria. A coded dispatch dated March 28, 1914, was sent to his government by the French military attaché at Sofia, reporting remarks that Ferdinand, King of Bulgaria, had made to his military leaders the previous day: "Let's not interfere with Serbia. Already the Serbs think they're big enough to defeat Austria. Before 6 months are up, they will attack her in alliance with Russia." The French government was clearly unconcerned about the prospect of an Austro-Serbian war 3 months before Sarajevo. Rather than seek to mediate, France busily supplied Serbia with the credit to build up its stocks of arms and material. A big French loan in September 1913 provided the impetus. French money not only armed the Serbs, it made Serbian leaders wealthy. As an example of the corruption spawned by the Franco-Serb-Russian politico-financial nexus, consider the affair of the Mauser rifles. On November 29, 1913, the Secretary General of the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Dragomir Stefanovic, drafted this letter to the French financier and press czar, Le Temps, Edgar Rolls: "Gentlemen. The matter of the rifles is urgent. Please consider it of the utmost urgency. Please tell me the earliest possible date the factory can complete the order. The price of the rifles can go as high as 80 francs apiece. The commissions must be included in the price. As I've told you, we are talking exclusively about the Mauser 7mm 1910 model. Since Mauser is in a cartel with the Austrian Steyr Works, we have misgivings about placing the order with Mauser here, as it will ultimately be Steyr which manufactures the guns, and it will be impossible to obtain the rifles if political conditions become complicated. That happened previously, in 1908. The shipment in question must be paid for from the proceeds of the loan made in France. Under no circumstances must anything be said to Mauser." The Mauser rifles purchased by Paris arrived in February and March, 1914, in Serbia. For their troubles, the following Serbian dignitaries received commissions: Prime Minister Pašić, 4.5 to 5% depending on the purchase, Vojvod Putnik got 3%, the court grand marshal and the finance marshal each received a 1% commission, and Serbia's generalissimo made out with 2%. Such was the level of indecency reached by this sort of looting that after the war the Yugoslavian Democratic Socialist Party would be able to accuse Nicholas Pašić of personally having stolen a million gold francs given by Russia to Serbia. The socialists would also accuse the former Serbian minister to Paris, Emir Vesnik, of having made off with another million in gold francs that had been authorized during the war for the care of the Serbian wounded. The Russians also set to work to draw Romania into the toils of her anti-Austrian agitation, for Romania was a crucial ally of Austria-Hungary, bound to her in a treaty that dated back to 1883. Grand Duke Nicholas, uncle of the Tsar, one of the most determined of the Pan-Slav warmongers, came to Bucharest to corrupt both the Romanian government and the royal family. He had immediate success with the Romanian Prime Minister, Tăi Ionescu. As Dragomir Stefanovic later revealed in his memoirs and documents of a Serbian diplomat. In December 1912, Tăi Ionescu met twice with Grand Duke Nicholas in the presence of our charge d'affaires at the Russian legation. It was in the course of the second of these conversations that a definite amount was set for the allowance which would thereafter be paid to the Romanian statesman as the price of the assistance he proposed to lend to Russia's anti-Austrian propaganda. The sum was to be 5,000 gold francs each month. Tăi Ionescu guaranteed the Grand Duke Nicholas that in the event of an Austro-Russian conflict, he and his friends, supported by the principal military leaders, in particular by Generals Filipescu and Averescu, would make it impossible for King Carol and his pro-German ministers to fulfill the obligations of the Treaty of Alliance linking Romania and the Austrian government since 1883. Lănescu's predecessor as Prime Minister, Marcoloman, managed to obtain and publish photographs of Ionescu's receipts. Ionescu, it was revealed, had also been subsidized by secret funds from Italy. And Ionescu himself had been subsidizing the French daily, Le Temps, and its agency in the Balkans, this money, of course, having come from the Russians, who themselves were being funded with huge French loans. Stefanovic noted in his memoirs, "As far as we personally, the Serbian Foreign Ministry, were concerned, we were assured from January 1913 on that when the decisive moment came, Romania would march with us against Austria-Hungary. The Germans were quick to catch on to the Russians' activity in Romania. In January 1913, the German minister to Bucharest telegraphed Berlin, the number of secret agents and spies that Russia has maintained in Romania for some months now is becoming prodigious. They are all concentrating their efforts on stirring up the country against Austria. I ask myself what they are driving at." In his turn, the German ambassador in Athens, Count Quat, telegraphed on March 1, 1913, "Russian propaganda is seeping down to the bottommost strata of the Romanian population. The Russians, who according to Ambassador Tskirschke, the German envoy to Austria-Hungary, had amassed a slush fund of a million rubles with which to bribe the Romanians, were ably seconded in their work by the French ambassador to Bucharest, Blondel. Blondel invited a steady stream of French politicians and journalists to Romania to spread the anti-Austro-Hungarian gospel, among them André Tardieu of Le Temps. Tardieu was, in Paris, the close confidant of the Russian ambassador, Alexander Izvolsky, who wrote his foreign minister, Sazonov, in 1912, "I have an interview with Monsieur Tardieu every other day." Tardieu was a slippery and unscrupulous dealer who had intrigued with a German diplomat in Paris to set up an illegal rubber consortium in the Congo, which would have brought him millions through front men, until the financial watchdog of the French Assembly, Joseph Kalos, had blown the whistle. 6 months before Sarajevo, Tardieu was authorized to offer the Romanians Transylvania, a part of Austria-Hungary, in exchange for their cooperation. Publicly and provocatively, Tardieu delivered a lecture titled "Transylvania is Romania's Alsace-Lorraine" in Bucharest. On June 24, 4 days before the assassination of the Archduke and his wife, Tăi Ionescu telegraphed Tardieu in code, "Agreement in principle, all points satisfactory, common interests concluded yesterday following conversation with Sazonov, Brașianu." On basis recognition our claims to Transylvania, Banat, Bukovina. Stop. All comments at present inopportune, latter follows by legation courier. On the same day the Russian endorsed the French guarantees to Romania. Later France's Georges Clemenceau would declare, of all the swine in the war, the Romanians were the most swinish. Perhaps this is a questionable judgment, there was swinishness all around at the time, particularly in the Balkans.